Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Welcome to Valley Public Radio's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk criminal justice with Fresno County's new Chief Probation Officer, Rick Chavez. He'll talk about his strategy to reduce recidivism and keep the worst offenders behind bars. We'll also learn how some farmers in the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta may soon be able to farm wetlands to sequester carbon. We'll find out what that means for those in agriculture and for the state's efforts to reduce global warming. We'll also talk with Dan Pisano of Fresno's Good Company Players Theater Group, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. Donald Monroe of the Fresno Bee, who is the author of a new book about the company, also joins us to tell us why GCP has lasted where so many others have struggled. But first, we turn to health care. In less than 3 months, millions of California residents will begin enrolling in expanded health coverage as part of the Affordable Care Act. The law is complex and touches almost every part of the healthcare system. But what does it mean for real people here in the San Joaquin Valley? Over the coming months, we'll explore that question by visiting with patients, doctors, businesses, and clinics in the community of Madera. It's a town that's home to more than 62,000 people, more than a quarter of which live below the poverty level. We'll start by examining how Madera County's only federally qualified health center is gearing up for Obamacare. Camarena Health expects to treat 25,000 patients this year, and even more once the key provisions of the health law take effect in January. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin explains how the clinic is preparing for an influx of newly insured patients.
It's Wednesday afternoon, and the waiting room at Camarena Health in Madera is filled with families.
Go ahead and have a seat.
For years, the clinic has received federal funding to provide primary care and dental services for the poor and uninsured. But with the expansion of coverage that's about to kick in under the new federal health law, big changes are on the way. Paulo Soares is the CEO of Camarena Health. He says preparing for the law has presented a number of challenges.
I think a lot of it is just new, and so there's just a lot of information being thrown at everyone at a very fast pace, not just consumers, but medical professionals, employers, etc., and really trying to figure out a lot of this as we move along.
And his team is moving fast to get ready for the law with an expansion of its own. Soares estimates that around 8,000 to 9,000 Madera County residents who are currently uninsured will become eligible for Medi-Cal in January.
Many of those patients may already be patients of ours, but may be not accessing care as regularly as they should.
Once they're insured, those patients may visit the health center more regularly. For example, he says, diabetic patients may no longer wait until they're very sick to seek care.
Hopefully what we'll see with the Medi-Cal expansion is that some of these folks who are now have coverage are now willing to come in every couple months and get some of the preventative care and allow our medical personnel to manage those diabetes, to have our health education staff work with them and keep them healthier and better manage their disease rather than, I can't afford it, so I'm only going to show up when it's really bad or too late.
Dealing with the surge in patients is just the first challenge. Another is providing the space and staff to care for them. 8 months ago, Camarena Health broke ground on a new 16,000-square-foot medical and dental facility, thanks to a $4.8 million federal grant. It will join the clinic's existing facilities in Madera, Chowchilla, and Oakhurst. But there are fewer remedies to the San Joaquin Valley's long-standing physician shortage.
Part of the capacity building is not only the physical space, the bricks and mortar, but once you build those buildings, we have to fill them with medical providers, physicians, mid-levels, as well as dentists. And so we are actively recruiting for all of those positions.
Another challenge is helping patients navigate the new health insurance options. Soares hopes to receive a grant from the federal government to educate people about the law's benefits.
The outreach and education is a very critical piece because Medicaid expansion is only going to really work if those who are eligible get enrolled. and access those services. And so if they're eligible for this program but they continue to walk around uninsured, it's not very beneficial to them.
Camarena is also striving to transform the way it provides care. It's part of a national initiative known as the Patient-Centered Medical Home. Dr. John Forncrook, Camarena's chief medical officer, explains that the goal is
to really pull a lot of the pieces together that are hanging loose right now. So, for instance, you know, keeping track of your patients, getting care at other places, getting information back from them, following up on that information you get back, and then making sure that people don't fall through the cracks.
One more challenge is providing care to the undocumented. They can receive services on a sliding fee scale at the health center, but they're generally not eligible for benefits of the health law. Without insurance, they may not be able to afford specialty services outside the health center. Soares again.
We will still do everything we can for the undocumented and or for just the uninsured. But once they leave our four walls and need more specialty care or hospitalization, that's where our coverage doesn't reach.
Go ahead and stand right here so I can check your height.
Despite some growing pains, Soares says the health law is good news for Madera.
If 8,000 to 9,000 more people can regularly receive health care and become healthier, it's a win, you know, across the board.
Enrollment for Medi-Cal is expected to begin in October. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca Plevin joins us now in the studio. Rebecca, this doctor shortage issue, we've heard about this for months, for years, but it's becoming very real, very quick for clinics like Camarena.
That's right, Joe. So the doctor shortage is a long existing issue in the San Joaquin Valley, but as more people are able to access healthcare regularly, there's going to be an increased demand for services, but the same supply of doctors. And when I asked the officials at Camarena, you know, is there any part of this law that keeps you up at night? What they said was they are concerned about this doctor shortage issue.
Sounds like it's a lot easier to build a building than it is necessarily to recruit all of the doctors and other assistants necessary to make this happen in real life.
Exactly. So right now, Camarena has about 15 full-time and part-time medical providers and 5 dentists, and they're looking to hire 3 more full-time doctors and 2 more full-time dentists. So it could be a challenge. We'll see.
Now, there's this term that you mentioned in the report called a patient-centered medical home. I've heard about this before, but it sounds, at least to the layperson, like a lot of really sophisticated language to describe something that might be a little more of a simple concept. What's behind the patient-centered medical home?
That's right. So Dr. John Forncrook, who is the chief medical officer at Camarena, you heard him describe it as a model of care that ensures that people don't fall through the cracks. And so it's a model of care that will aim to coordinate patients' primary and preventative care through one doctor. So they'll be overseeing all of that, making sure that people aren't going to the ER unnecessarily, aren't getting tests that they've already gotten before. And so the idea is to improve patient care and keep costs down.
Sounds like a new name for kind of an old idea. You're going to be going to Madera throughout the next few months to report on different elements of how this law is impacting the community.
That's right. So we're hoping to look at how this law impacts all segments of the community. So we will be talking to businesses. How are they getting ready to provide care, to provide insurance to their employees? We'll be looking at families maybe who are able to access insurance for their first time. Maybe we'll look at people who still will be left out of this law. So we'll be looking at all different segments of the population and how this law will affect them.
Well, Rebecca, thank you very much for that report, and we look forward to future ones in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Joe.
We move on from one element of the healthcare law to another. The summer is a slow time for many occupations, but not for people working to make fundamental changes to the healthcare system. Millions of uninsured Americans are expected to buy coverage through the new health insurance marketplaces called exchanges. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone has more about how neighboring states are trying to achieve the same end by different means.
In less than 3 months, people around the U.S. will be able to log onto a website and shop for health insurance. Until that time, state governments are racing to secure contracts and get IT systems in place. Some states, like Nevada, resisted the Affordable Care Act at the Supreme Court, but it's been implementing the ACA for a couple of years. John Hager is director of Nevada's Health Insurance Exchange, Nevada HealthLink.
having that, I don't know if it's schizophrenia, if you will, challenging the ACA but implementing at the same time has actually benefited us.
Hager says the healthcare system over the next couple of years will involve a lot of moving parts.
There are going to be changes to rates. There's going to be changes to plan designs, to service areas, to the networks. So a lot of things that are changing, so much so that it's difficult to put your finger on what we think a plan should look like.
So Hager says the Nevada strategy is to see how the market develops. Nevada HealthLink will function as a free market facilitator. That means any insurance company that meets federal standards can apply to serve the state's pool of customers. Hager says Nevada's exchange will be business friendly.
Carriers, you provide a range of products that you think are appropriate for Nevada's consumers. Consumers, you pick whatever you think is best. We'll go through a couple years and look at what consumers decide, and then we'll evaluate at that point whether or not it makes sense to make any changes to the market.
Just across the Sierra in California, the construction of a new healthcare framework means dealing with insurance companies quite differently.
We're picking plans that are best for consumers instead of letting the plans pick consumers that are best for them.
Peter Lee is executive director of Covered California, the Golden States Exchange.
It's like we're a large employer saying we want to offer four or five health plans that do the best job.
Covered California is an active purchaser, which means the government agency negotiates directly with insurance companies, which Lee says has resulted in the best rates and benefits for consumers. Lee says at first, 30 health plans wanted to be in the new market.
Some of them dropped out pretty quick when they saw what it meant to be a plan that we were going to contract with, meaning they've got to do a good job on chronic care management. They need to do prevention, wellness. They need to improve care. So we started right out of the gate with raising the bar.
We wanted to find out more about the differences between the two state exchanges, so we got Peter Lee in California and John Hager in Nevada on a conference call to compare notes.
My staff is only going to be 13 people, where I believe Peter's staff is going to be, what's your target, Peter, 1,100?
We'll be close to 1,100. And again, that's
Nevada has chosen a private contractor to manage its call center. California's call center will be staffed by state employees. Consumers will log on to Covered California's website and compare standardized health plans. In Nevada, the plan options will be shown side by side. They will not be standardized. But perhaps the biggest difference is size.
Yes, our entire population is 2.7 million, so pretty much Covered California can enroll our entire population, it sounds like.
While California anticipates more than a million customers next year, Nevada expects just over 100,000. Carolyn Pearson from the Washington, D.C.-based consulting firm Avalier Health says a smaller market may make it hard to attract carriers, and that could affect prices.
Where we get concerned is the states that are small and therefore don't have enough plan interest to have the competition that drives those premiums down. So, you know, Vermont only has two health plans, and their premiums are looking relatively high compared to the rest of the country.
Pearson says vigorous competition or negotiation can keep costs down. But Pearson says the state styles of government won't make much difference when people shop online next year.
From a very basic consumer level, there's not going to be a tremendous difference between the two approaches.
It's too soon to tell what Nevada's health insurance marketplace will look like. Details on the plans and rates will be announced next September. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. A new version of term limits, a new way to draw voting districts, a new system for running primary elections. Those three changes all took effect in 2012. Each was intended to moderate the California legislature. As Katie Orr reports from Sacramento, there is hope that changes have been effective, but so far, there's no proof.
New lawmakers are frequently sworn in at the California State Capitol, but the class taking the oath of office last December faced a different legislative future from classes who came before them.
I, please state your name, do solemnly swear.
A new term limit law allows members to serve 12 years in one house rather than restricting them to 6 years in the Assembly and 8 in the Senate.
And the Constitution of the State of California.
That means the freshman assembly members being sworn in could spend over a decade in one house. That's exciting for Republican Assemblyman Travis Allen, who's serving his first term.
There's an ability with this new freshman class to really stand up in a way that previous legislative sessions have not been able to, and to say, look, we now have 12 years to go do the right thing. And I think that we'll start to see a lot of legislators look beyond their traditional party lines to work together to find comprehensive solutions for the complex and large challenges that California faces.
It's very early, but I'm hopeful.
Political scientist Steve Boylard says the change to term limits was just one of the measures meant to make the legislature more moderate. Giving a citizens' commission power over voting district boundaries and switching to an open primary system were also meant to have moderating effects. Boylard points out all three were voter-approved ballot measures.
You get the feeling that people are frustrated and are kind of searching for some way to improve what they perceive to be problems with our legislative process. And I think those are partisan gridlock and lack of expertise.
Boylard says a lot of institutional memory was lost when term limits were first introduced in 1990. He says this latest change will help restore some of that memory. Assembly Republican leader Connie Conway has about a year and a half left in office before she's forced out of the assembly. The woman who sometimes calls herself the grandmother of the assembly says she sees a freshman class with an eye on long-term goals rather than short-term action focused on the next election.
I really believe it's a better opportunity because, as I say, 6 years, especially in an arena like this, it can be very high stress. I think that having the more time and opportunity can lead to a better focused legislature.
But a more moderate one? Conway isn't yet convinced.
I know that was the intention. For me, the verdict's still out. I don't know. On both sides. The time will tell.
There's evidence a strong partisan divide still exists in Sacramento. Republicans regularly rise to object to bills passing through the Democratic-controlled legislature, and they're regularly ignored. But freshman Democratic Assemblywoman Christina Garcia says she's already seen signs of progress, a lot of it because of the bipartisan nature of the freshman lawmakers.
Republicans and Democrats, we interact at our events, we help each other on bills. You know, I know in the past the Republicans haven't crossed the aisle for much of anything, but the freshmen here in particular not only cross the aisle, but they bring their counterparts with them. So there's been bills where you expect Republicans to completely oppose, and the freshmen will help get a unanimous vote out on the floor.
So is the legislature on its way toward a new period of moderate bipartisanship? It may take years to know for sure, but all sides seem to hope we're seeing the dawn of a new political era for California. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us in just a moment. Fresno County has a new chief probation officer. We'll talk with Rick Chavez and find out about his strategy for realignment and much more. It's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Over the past few years, by far the biggest news in the world of criminal justice in California has been something called realignment. As the state struggled to reduce its prison population, in 2011 it turned to counties for the answer, shifting some lower-level offenders from state-run prisons to county-run jails. Counties got more money from the state to pay for the new inmates, but they also took on more responsibilities, including in probation. Here to tell us more about how realignment is working here in Central California is Rick Chavez. Next month, he will become Fresno County's new chief probation officer, taking over for Linda Penner, who is leaving to head the Board of State and Community Corrections. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been with the department a long time. How have you seen it change? How have you seen the world of corrections change since 1984 when you became a probation officer in Fresno County?
Well, there's been really tremendous change in the type of population that we deal with, both at the juvenile and adult level. You know, we always say in community corrections, we're always on a pendulum. It swings from rehabilitation to enforcement back and forth, you know. And And right now, we're sort of in the middle once again, rehabilitation and incarceration and enforcement. And that's one of the great things about being a probation officer. You can wear many hats. You can be a social worker. You can be almost a police officer. And then somewhere in between is where the ideal officer meets. You know, you have to be able to empathize with your clients, yet you also have to hold them accountable and enforce those orders of the court when you're working with them. The same thing for our officers that work in the juvenile institutions. They're role models for those juvenilesTrying to make a difference in their lives so they won't impact the system any further. So at this point, tremendous change, especially with AB 109, the criminal justice realignment. That's probably the greatest change that we've seen in community corrections since 1977 when determinant sentencing law went into effect in the state. It's just a huge, huge change, a great shift of responsibility from the state agencies to the local agencies, to the probation department, the sheriff's department, district attorney, public defender. We're all impacted to some degree. It's a great responsibility that we were given relatively a very short time to come up with our own local plans. And keep in mind, it's 58 local plans because every county is charged with their own way in which they're going to deal with this new population that we're supervising. So I think for the amount of time that we had to implement and the fact we're only into it a little over 18 months, I think we've done a very good job with this increased responsibility. And I look forward to continuing where Chief Penner has charted for us in the department, going on and providing public safety while also providing that level of rehabilitation that will hopefully reduce the recidivism rate of this new population.
You mentioned the tremendous changes brought about by the realignment plan, AB 109. It's now been in place, almost 2 years now. What did it mean? What sort of strain did it put on your department at first? I understand that the workload increased so much with all of these new offenders that you're responsible for supervising.
It put a great strain on us. We were initially dealing with some projections from the state month by month for how many of these offenders we'd receive. These projections, of course, they weren't quite correct. So we were hit with three times the amount of offenders that we thought we were going to get initially. So we're still trying to play catch up to get our supervision caseloads down to where they need to be at 1 to 50. Just as we were hit, so was everyone else. The sheriff was hit with increased numbers. The courts have been greatly impacted by this shift as far as the amount of hearings. And now, starting just July 1, now the courts will also hear all the parole revocation hearings, which they were not doing before. Those were going to the parole board. So it had a huge, huge impact, and not only with our supervision levels, but also with the programs that we needed to put in place, because you just can't supervise someone without having those programs that are meaningful that will address their needs. And we see that so many of these individuals have significant drug problems, which then fuel other criminal activity. So we have a drug addict. He's trying to feed his habits. So he's going to go out and steal a car, going to go out and burglarize a house, going to go out and shoplift, do something. So it's tightly intertwined. And without services for those folks, we're just going to be a revolving door. And that's not the goal of realignment. The goal of realignment is to impact that population and to provide a greater degree of public safety while addressing those offenders' needs.
You mentioned that. That's a big concern for a lot of people. And it seems that when there is a crime involving someone who is part of the AB 109 realignment reforms, when one of those offenders recommits a crime, that receives a lot of media attention and there's a lot of outcry in the public about things. What do you think that, not asking you to critique Fresno County before you even start officially on the job, but looking at the statewide level, you've been involved in the Community Corrections Partnership here at the Fresno County level, but you've also had a chance to look at what other counties are doing. What are some of the best approaches, or what are the best practices? Are there some real shining examples of we can go this direction? This is maybe the path that has the biggest potential for success?
Well, I think when you look at the Central Valley, Fresno, from Fresno up to Merced, down to Kern and all those other counties in between there, Kings, we were greatly impacted by realignment. The numbers that came into us were far beyond what was the initial estimate. So the workload we had was much greater than, for instance, some of the other counties around the state. Now, there are some really great programs in those other counties, great pretrial programs, which we started now, reentry programs, which we're working on with our partners in the Sheriff's Department, day reporting centers, in-custody treatment programs. There's a lot of good things out there that are going on that we're trying to replicate. And I think, like you say, we just started October 1 of 11, so we're, you know, a little over a year and a half into realignment. It's really too early to tell how some of these programs are going to work out, but you have to realize that when you take on this huge obligation and you start these new programs, it takes a little while for them to get up and running so you can really see the results, so you can really evaluate, is this what's working? Is this what the evidence tells us? Is this evidence-based practices at its best in Fresno County? And that's what we're looking at right now to evaluate. So I think we have to be cognizant of the fact we have to have programs available for the courts. The court's going to have confidence in when they sentence these local offenders to time in the county jail. Is there some type of treatment involved? Is there a treatment after they're released? Are there all these other issues out there that we need to have in place? And we're on that path right now, but as I say, a little over a year and a half in, we've come a long way, but we also have a long way to go. And we're on the right path, and it's my goal as the chief probation officer to keep us on that path.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Rick Chavez. He is soon to become Fresno County's new chief probation officer, effective in early August of this year. One of the things that people don't hear a lot about in the news so much, but is an important part of how this all works, is the collaboration between different law enforcement agencies and chiefs of all these different agencies. They get together as part of this group called the Community Corrections Partnership and meet several times a year. And that, as I understand it, is a group really in charge of implementing this realignment plan. Tell me a little more about what that group does and your philosophy on collaborating with other top law enforcement officials in the county.
Well, first I'll start off with collaboration. You can't get anything done in a silo. That's obvious. We know that. History tells us that. So we have to go out and we have to collaborate. We have to be willing to work with each other, and which we've done with realignment amongst the sheriff, the district attorney, the various police departments. The money's never enough. It's never going to be enough. We realize that coming. No matter how much money we get from the state, it's never going to be enough to take on this huge obligation. So we have to work together with each other, and we have to go out there and not be afraid to help each other when it's needed, to support each other when it's needed. And I think one of those examples is our adult compliance team, the ACT team. It's part of realignment. And that's comprised of members from the probation department, district attorney's office, sheriff's department, Fresno PD, and Clovis PD. And that's sort of our, I don't want to say our enforcement team, but they go out there, they're schooled in evidence-based practices, motivational engineering. They go out, and when there's a problem with one of our realigned offenders, they're the sort of the folks that go out and get that person back on track. And that can be take many forms, not just arrest, but it could be getting them back into treatment. It could be taking them to see his counselor, all those types of things. So without collaboration, we're not going to get too far. Now, the Community Corrections Partnership, that's part of the legislation in AB 109. Every county has a Community Corrections Partnership that was tasked with developing their own local plan. Now, the Chief Probation Officer chairs that, but it's comprised in our county of the Chief of Police of Fresno, Jerry Dyer, our District Attorney, Beth Egan, Sheriff Margaret Mims, our Director of Behavioral Health, Dewan Utek, and Sharon Morton, our Court Administrator, as well as Ken Taniguchi, the Public Defender. These are the folks that devise the plan that's responsible for implementing realignment in the county. And then that plan is presented to the Board of Supervisors for the board to ultimately approve the plan, and we go forth from there and work realignment as best we can.
Has that plan changed at all in this past year as realignment has progressed on? We've had some experience with it. Has that plan evolved in any way?
We just finished our second year budget and plan, and what we've done, we've added more treatment. We found out pretty quickly that it was just lacking in treatment. The initial plan dealt with supervision, caseloads, jail floors opening here in Fresno. You know, we had issues with a lack of capacity, so we had to address that through the plan. We opened two jail floors, added 26 probation officers, but we didn't have a lot of treatment. Put a day reporting center in place. So we came back rather quickly, and through the help of behavioral health, through that great collaboration again, we were able to leverage some additional money through the Mental Health Services Act, putting in some money from the CCP, to where we really have a meaningful mental health service and substance abuse service available for that population. Right now we're looking at adding homeless beds for some of these offenders to try to stabilize them, to get them the case management and services that they need, as well as job training, which is very important for this population. So, yeah, it has changed somewhat. what I would like to see is that continued further, more services. You know, if we have enough supervision officers, we have what we've done with the jail, we need to really concentrate on getting that comprehensive service program out there for these offenders.
Rick Chavez, Fresno County's new chief probation officer, to take the job in early August, taking over for Linda Penner. Rick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Agriculture in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta has flourished thanks to rich organic soils. But after more than 100 years of farming, those soils are eroding, and the interiors of many Delta islands are sinking. California may have a solution that would not only help farmers, but could also combat climate change. Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento.
Twitchell Island lies in the middle of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and it's in trouble. Some inland areas are 25 feet below sea level. Levees prevent the waters of the San Joaquin River from rushing in. But at that low elevation, water still manages to seep through the soil. James Casey says that makes farming on Twitchell Island difficult.
Some of this land becomes so hard to farm because the water issues, it's too much to pump the water out. There's a cost right there with the district for pumping the water out. We have problems that we have to deepen ditches, and it gets so wet out there that you can't really farm it.
Tractors have been known to sink into the peat-rich soil. It's a soil that's great for crops, but highly susceptible to subsidence, a massive drop in elevation that's occurring on many of the Delta's islands. The further the land drops, the more difficult it becomes to farm, and the more at risk it is to a levee breach and flooding. The peat also emits carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas. But there's a way to capture those emissions and prevent subsidence at the same time. Farmers can grow wetlands.
The wetland is a carbon sink, and the Delta peat lands are a carbon source, a greenhouse gas source.
Brian Brock is an engineer with the California Department of Water Resources. He's standing in front of two fields. On the left is a restored wetland where tall grasses called tules grow in abundance.
To the right of us, we've got probably one of the deepest holes on Twitchell Island. The elevation is negative 22 feet below sea level.
Brock says the experiment proves that tules can reverse subsidence, and flooding soils stops microbes from breaking down carbon in the peat and sending it up into the atmosphere. Tules also suck up carbon in the air. That carbon storage could create a potential market.
We're hoping to prove the numeric values of that, which will allow us to sell carbon credits and allow other landowners, including farmers, to take their marginal lands and set that into carbon farming.
Farmers could sell credits to businesses trying to reduce their carbon footprint in California's cap and trade system. Getting farmers to grow tules might be difficult, but rice farming shows similar potential for sequestering carbon. Dennis Baldacci, a biometeorology professor at UC Berkeley, is trying to figure out just how much.
First of all, we're seeing huge year-to-year variability in how much carbon is sequestered, because last year the rice got in late, there was a short growing season, there wasn't much photosynthesis, there was weeds galore. And essentially that whole system actually lost carbon to the atmosphere. This year, it looks beautiful. I'm really impressed. Looks the best ever.
Early estimates show growing tules or rice could remove 7 to 20 metric tons of greenhouse gas per acre per year. But researchers stress the numbers are very preliminary. James Casey says if he can farm crops and sequester carbon, it's a win-win for him, even if it might be difficult.
I think that if you manage it right, there's a way to do both. I'm hoping that we can leave this land a little bit better than what we got it, at least our generation. I don't want my kids to have to deal with it. If that means build the soil some other way, tules, and if that's the answer, then I would say that do it.
Dennis Baldacci says there's another crucial reason for this project to succeed at reversing subsidence. If the levees break, the resulting flood would shut down the state's water project.
This is my concern. We're the 7th or 8th largest economy in the world. This little sets of islands, if they burst, we're going to essentially shut down water for 20 million people and shut down this great, huge economy.
By 2017, the Department of Water Resources plans to restore about 4,000 acres of wetlands as a test for carbon farming. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You can see pictures of restored wetlands and information on potential for storing carbon on our website at kvpr.org. While some California farmers are searching for solutions to climate change, is it enough? On this segment of FM89's commentary series known as The Moral Is, Fresno State philosophy professor Dr. Andrew Fiala asks whether, like Nero, we're fiddling while Rome burns.
President Obama recently announced a new initiative on climate change. But will we be able to address climate change in time to prevent the worst that is predicted? I doubt it. Decades of dithering about global warming do not inspire hope. In the spring of 2013, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere hit a new high of 400 parts per million. This concentration has not been seen on Earth for 2.5 million years, when the Earth was 3 degrees centigrade warmer than it is today. CO2 concentrations are rising, and there is no concrete plan to slow things down. Like Nero, we're fiddling while Rome burns. But why not fiddle? It's rational to enjoy yourself today and ignore the risk of catastrophic future harm. Our brains are programmed by evolution to maximize our own short-term happiness. A few of us may make self-sacrificial choices, and some do prepare for their children's futures, but in general, we maximize our own self-interest in the near to mid-future. We simply have no motivation to scrimp today for the well-being of unborn generations. We are not programmed to take collective action to prevent long-term and speculative risks. Climate-friendly behavior can look positively irrational. Individuals can bike to work or avoid using the air conditioning, for example. But why should I sacrifice my short-term happiness when no one else does? What's the point of biking to work if everyone else is driving? What's the point of dialing back the AC when the folks next door are blasting theirs? That sort of thinking is connected to a problem that philosophers call the prisoner's dilemma. It turns out that if we suspect others of being self-interested, we won't cooperate, and we will each choose to pursue our own self-interest. But when everyone pursues their own self-interest, we end up with worse outcomes. The result is tragedy. Climate change requires massive cooperation at the global and corporate level. But we don't trust each other. We won't sacrifice our short-term happiness, and we simply don't plan for the distant future. Affluent Americans will be able to surf the waves of climate change, but the poor will not. And here again is the problem. In a hot, crowded future, poor people will want to blast the AC and drive big cars, and affluent people will not willingly give up what we've got. The hotter it gets, the worse the problem may become. I hope some political genius can solve this difficulty. But the future looks bleak. The mercury is rising. And while we should be tuning up our bikes, most of us are tuning up our fiddles. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
And you can see more commentaries from The Moral Is series on our website, kvpr.org. Stay with us on Valley Edition in just a moment. We'll talk with Dan Pisano of Fresno's Good Company Players Theater Group, celebrating 40 years this year. Donald Monroe of the Fresno Bee also joins us. He's the author of a new book about the company. We'll talk with them and find out how Good Company Players has lasted for so long. That's coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition. Listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. For generations, Fresno residents have laughed and cried with the actors of the Good Company Players. Now celebrating 40 years on the stage in Fresno's Tower District, the Community Theater Company and its founder Dan Pisano are the subject of a new ebook from Fresno Bee features writer Donald Monroe called The Company We Keep. It's available for download on the Kindle store and on iTunes. Both Donald Monroe and Dan Pisano join us now to talk about it and the company's anniversary. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Donald, I want to start with you. This is something of a departure for you and the Bee and from what you normally do as a features writer. This is a 20,000-word ebook. It's the first one that the Bee has done that I'm aware of. There have been some other publications that have done ebooks. The Bakersfield Californian has been doing this for a while. Why this story? Why an ebook in this case?
Well, we decided
first of all, that we knew that we were going to cover this story really well because Good Company is such a treasured part of the community. And as I started thinking about how I'm going to cover this story, I thought to myself, why not use this as kind of an experiment for our first e-book? And so I pitched the idea to all the editors involved, and then more importantly, I pitched it to Dan and his family, and they agreed to spend the time that it would take to do a project like this, and we just got rolling.
And 20,000 words, that's considerably larger than a feature in Spotlight or in
it
the
is. It's,
feature
it's very, very much longer. And I actually had a really good time putting it together. It was fun to be able to get in depth and to have different chapters in the book talk about various parts of the company's history and to talk about Dan and his wonderful family.
What was that like, sort of immersing yourself in Dan, and first for you, Donald, and then I'll hear from Dan and his thoughts.
Well, I think Dan referred to the whole process as watching paint dry on more than one occasion. But to me, I thought it was fascinating. We all are aware of what Dan does on stage and also that he directs a lot of shows there. But there are so many things he does behind the scenes. And so that was one of the best parts of this project, was just to be able to kind of follow him around a little and watch him do everything from record the phone message for the next show to giving that final farewell and the final expense checks to the cast of the departing show.
Dan, did you have any second thoughts when Donald said he wanted to do this book?
I just worried about him. I thought of all the times that you got an assignment at school and they said, okay, you have to write 200 words. And I remember thinking, 200 words? I don't know 200 words. So for someone to take on that project and so carefully, so thoroughly, I really couldn't understand how he could not be bored out of his tree with this. But I just think we have known, first of all, I would say over 40 years, the bee has been very important to our lifeblood anyway. And I think Donald's underrated in terms of his contribution to all of the arts groups. So there's a secure friendship and professional trust and all of that that's been built up. So, I knew he would approach it in the way he does approach things, thoroughly and fact-checking and all of that. But it just struck me that anybody that would want to follow us around, really, they better get their running shoes on in the first place. And he did a great job of it. So I wasn't threatened in any way. I didn't edit my usual language or anything that I can recall.
Not at all. They almost put me to work a couple times, too.
Yeah, that is true.
You've been known to do that.
Yes.
Again, we're talking with Dan Pisano, founder of the Good Company Players in Fresno, now celebrating 40 years on the stage in our community, and Donald Monroe, feature writer for the Fresno Bee and the author of a new ebook called The Company We Keep about the company's 40th anniversary. Dan, 40 years ago, did you have any idea what you were getting into?
No, and that's probably why we made it. The cliche that's the cliche is the next 10 minutes. I don't really believe we ever looked past what was going to be the next night, whether it be the rehearsal or what has to happen with the set or anything. I think we knew that the abilities were there. So, we always have a lot of potential, and we've always found a lot of potential and hopefully developed it. But I don't think you do much more than sit down in February to plan the next season and think of it in that regard, just one foot in front of the other.
It might have been easier in some respects to sit back and let somebody else take on this task, to let somebody else found a company like what GCP has become. Why did you do it?
Well, I think the moons were in the right place. We had talented people that were appropriately arrogant. We knew that we were good and wanted to share that. We thought we could do something special. I don't know that there's ever a why in there. I think it happens. I think when you're together and you know you have something and you're driven, theater is like that. It's something that it's no fun talking about it. We wanted to do it. And so I believe that's as much a part of it as anything, just having the right people and the right opportunity.
Donald, Dan is such a character himself. For those of us who know him, for our listeners who may not have firsthand experience with him, he's obviously central to the company and its success. How would you describe him?
Well, careful.
Yes, very, very carefully. You know, Dan is a quiet person in many ways. He is a very reserved person. And I think that might come as a surprise to people who've seen him in all sorts of characters on stage. But he isn't the kind of person I feel who comes into a room and dominates it. And I think a lot of people have this idea that actors are very outsized personalities. Now, he also has a very commanding presence. And so especially when he walks into a room with his actors, they all know that he's there. But it was interesting to see him interact with the people he works so closely with. He also, I really feel, has a tremendous sense of loyalty to the people that he works with. You know, he told me that he has two families. I mean, it's his wife and daughter, but also those folks who have been with him for so many years working at the company. And you really sense that when you walk into the office. I mean, these people are in it together. And I think that's one thing that I was really struck by.
You've covered a lot of different arts organizations, a lot of different theater groups. The average lifespan is, let's be generous and say, a bit shorter than 40 years.
It is. It's tough to keep a theater company together. And I think most really successful theater companies have a very strong central character who is at the heart of that company. And I think Dan has really served that role, or GCP.
Dan, what do you think not the secret, because I don't know that there is a secret, but what do you think the ingredients have been to your success in longevity in this area?
Well, I think we have huge pride in our work. I think our expectations are high, higher of ourselves than they would ever allow the audience to have expectations of us even. We expect to give them their money's worth, et cetera, but we know quicker than they'll ever know whether we're doing the job that night or during the run of that show, and we stay after it. So I think high expectations is part of it, and I think everybody on staff shares that. And then, you know, an important ingredient for my staff, and they are so important to what we've accomplished, is we kind of share a sense of humor so that we're able to keep it going without actually going up on the rocks. We have a rule. We never yell at rehearsals. Every once in a while something goes wrong and you'll yell freeze or something at tech rehearsals. Usually you have a lot of that, but we don't. We agree to keep it quiet and solve it. So I'd say, you know, pride and consistency and sanity.
Was there ever a time when you thought, why am I doing this? Is this really what I'm supposed to be doing? Is this where we should be going? Is this what I should be spending my life's work on?
Not so much life's work on it, but I'd have to say I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof right now, and I have that thought just before I go out to sing Rich Man every night. You know, I think here goes 5 minutes out of everybody's life. And no, I think there are doubts. Not, I think, personal as well as company-wise. Sometimes we just get our feelings hurt. One of the most wonderful things about the book is I wasn't sure anybody noticed. You know, a lot of people have chimed in the book and said wonderful things and been very kind and written us lately. And it's not that I don't know that they're there, but you don't know until somebody says something that they notice. And so, you know, those are the moments where you're just working and plugging along and you're wondering, is anybody there? Is anybody out there?
Turning back to Donald Monroe, what do you think GCP has meant for the community as a whole, both the immediate arts community and then the folks who go to the shows, mm-hmm. the community at large?
Well, I think it's meant a great deal, specifically to the theater scene. I think the Fresno theater scene is really alive right now. And if you were to trace back the genealogy of these newer companies that have come along, I mean, GCP is just in the DNA. I mean, it was there. I think its consistency, the what Dan has often referred or talks about in terms of consistency of the product, it's created an audience in Fresno who knows that they can get quality theater, and they're willing to take that risk. They're willing to part with their precious dollars to go out and experience live theater. You know, live theater has so many obstacles today in terms of all the different entertainments that are out there. You know, we've become so much more of a passive society. I mean, you can just sit on your couch and download Netflix all night. And so to actually get somebody out to the theater, I think GCP has really made Fresno a much brighter place.
At the risk of using 21st century corporate speak to describe an artistic endeavor, what you're really talking about is the Good Company Players brand is really strong.
It is. It is, definitely. And that's something that you just can't move in and you can't accomplish that in just a season or two. It's really something that takes a while. You know, I was talking to a neighbor of mine who read some of the stories that we ran in the paper that excerpted parts of the book, and she told me about going to see a production of 12 Angry Men. This was years ago. It was the first time that she'd been to live theater, and she still got chills yesterday when she was telling me about that moment. And I don't know what it was about that show that touched her so much, but it was an important part of her life. And I never knew that she went to the theater, that something like that could touch someone I knew in that way.
Dan, you've touched a lot of lives through your work, through the company's work. What is that like, hearing those stories, people talking about a show from 15 years ago, 20 years ago? I remember this. I remember that. You played such an important role in the lives of so many what are now acclaimed artists. I don't even have to read the list because we all know them. But what's that been like, being reminded of that and going through this process, going through the 40th anniversary, the big production you had? What has that been like?
Well, that's the most emotional part of it. There's no doubt about it. You know, I've said that I don't think you take credit. Credit has to be given. And if this is about all of Good Company Players, not specifically me, but if this experience has made a difference to audience or performers or something, and they tell us that after the fact, that's a huge review. That's as nice a thing as can happen to you. And so we've heard from a lot of young people that are now over 30 and over 40. They're mad at me for saying that, but have gone through the program. And they all kind of say the same things that are important to us about self-discipline and consideration and being polite and being on time and being prepared and how that applies to the rest of your life. And for audience members, they have specific memories and they have watched people and will tell you that they knew without a doubt the first time they ever saw Audra in the junior company, Audra McDonald, that she was going to win 5 Tonys. I mean, we all have that proprietorship. So it's very rewarding, very.
We're talking with Dan Pisano, founder of the Good Company Players, and Donald Monroe of the Fresno Bee, and the author of a new ebook called The Company We Keep. Donald, turning back to you, there's a business side to this story as well. And one thing that makes Good Company Players maybe a little bit different than a lot of the other arts organizations in our community is they're a for-profit business. They are a family business, as you describe in your book. Talk about that aspect of it and what you see from your perspective as a reporter covering this story and how that's maybe affected them and what they do on a daily basis.
Well, I mean, it is a pretty remarkable story. Most theater companies in this country are nonprofit. And indeed, GCP did have a tiny stint for about 6 months, I think it was, that it did try the nonprofit route. But there are a lot of challenges in running a nonprofit organization, including having to sort of give up some creative control and then also having to, fill out a lot of paperwork. And and so I think it's really interesting that Dan and his family kind of chose this route. Now, it also means that they have to be even more responsive to the audience than if it were a nonprofit organization. Although that's not really the case either, because nonprofits ultimately do, they just can't keep producing stuff that people don't go to see. But, you know, Dan is very forthright about, you know, putting people in the seats, and to him, the audience is all important. And as he says, if there isn't an audience there, then there isn't really a show going on. And so I think it's interesting that the organization has taken that route over the years.
Is it tough to wear both of those hats, one businessman, one artist?
Yes. Although I think they all blend together. I think the decisions you make when you're doing season selection are those times where the artist in you probably tugs pretty hard at some of your favorite projects, and the businessman says, yes, but I have a staff of seven people, full-time people in the shops, and another five people in the office, et cetera. So I'm making a decision. We're all making a decision based on the facts there. So, yeah, I think there's a tug.
You just celebrated your 40th anniversary. What about the next 40 years? What does the future hold for Good Company Players? What are your intentions? This is something you've been involved with from the beginning. Does this have a future beyond your involvement with the company at some point?
Well, I hope so. You know, people have remarked at how old I am, and so I don't buy green bananas, you know, that joke. As George Burns said, I can't really die, I'm booked. But my family is certainly an important part of it, but my family includes the rest of the staff. David Pierce and Ginger Lewis and Linda Thayer and all of the people on staff, they're what will keep the ball rolling. I intend to, you know, as I say, we're selling seats for next year because we're here. And so that's the here about it. That's the next 10 minutes.
Before we go, gentlemen, I want to give both of you an opportunity to tell our listeners one more time about your individual projects. Donald, your book?
Well, I would remind people that you actually don't have to own an e-book reader or a tablet device to actually read this project. You can you can get it online through Amazon or through a website called Vook. That's VOOK.com. And you can just basically read it on your computer. So I've had some people asking me, you know, how can I read this? I don't have a Kindle. And it's like, well, it's pretty easy to do.
And Dan, you're in production of Fiddler on the Roof right now.
Well, Fiddler on the Roof goes to the 14th, but a good example of where our life goes on, we have a brand new show called Curtains. Very funny whodunit. The leading lady is so bad that they kill her and everybody celebrates. You know, it's our dream of what we would do with a performer that really is terrible. And spend the show trying to solve it. So we're excited about that. That's a July 18th opening, and it's something new. And so we're all – and my family's involved, and so I get to be an audience for a while.
Family, indeed, in more ways than one. Again, our guests today have been Dan Pisano, the founder of Fresno's Good Company Players, celebrating 40 years on the stage in Fresno's Tower District, and Donald Monroe of the Fresno Bee. He is the author of a new ebook called The Company We Keep. It's available online at your favorite ebook retailer. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. See you again next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.